Well, it's good to be with you this morning. For those of you who may not recognize me, my name is Colby Wilbur. I'm the youth pastor here at Cross Point Church. And in Pastor Jerry's continued absence, as he is going around the world to Vietnam and China and different places, he has asked for me to fill in today, and it's my privilege to do so. As we are going to study and continue our study of the book of 1 Samuel today, we're going to be in chapter 21. So I would encourage you, if you have your Bibles or your phones or your apps, to turn to chapter 21. I was at a youth conference with a couple small group leaders yesterday, and one of the phrases they said was, you know, if you have this, the battery never runs out. I thought that was kind of funny, and I'm definitely going to be using that in the teen ministry to get them to try to use these instead. So teens, if you're in here, you're going to hear that phrase a lot more. It might even be on a poster at some point. So it's a privilege to be with you this morning. We're going to be in chapter 21. What I want to do is to go through a little bit of a review. So I'm hoping that there are some new faces here this morning, and even if there aren't, we've covered a lot of ground over the last couple months in the story of 1 Samuel and in the reading, especially of the character of King David. And so what I want to do is I want to do a quick review like we do in our youth ministry and go through some of the things that we've talked about. Chapter 16 is where King David gets introduced. He's not a king at that point. He is still a shepherd boy. But in chapter 16, we see that David is anointed to be the future king by Samuel the prophet. Saul has made some decisions that has caused God to remove his spirit from him, and God had chose David. Even before David was seen in the field, he knew that he was going to be the next king. So they go and anoint him in chapter 16. And then later in chapter 16, starting in verse 14, we see that he is brought to serve the king by way of music, and he becomes Saul's armor bearer. Saul, not having the Spirit of the Lord on him now, he often has these moments where an evil spirit will harm him. And we have talked about that as we went through chapter 16 in teaching here on Sunday mornings. But what happened was he needed some relief and some help in those situations. And someone in his palace, in his court said, you know, I know a guy. His name's David. And he knows how to play the harp and the lyre well. And so David was actually brought in, so when Saul had these moments of being tormented by this evil spirit, that David would play the harp or the lyre and it would help soothe him. And we see later in chapter 17 with Goliath, David was Saul's armor bearer. This is part of the narrative of 1 Samuel that most people are familiar with. It's chapter 17. So Goliath, if you don't know, he was a 9-foot-tall, 9-inch Philistine that was a commander of their army. And he was challenging the nation of Israel for 40 days. He's challenging for someone to fight him. And he said, if someone from Israel can defeat me, the Palestinians or the Philistines will be under the service of Israel. But if I can beat one of you, then you will be under our service. And for many days, nobody faced Goliath because it seems impossible. Lo and behold, David, the shepherd boy, he doesn't even have a problem with this. He walks in, and we often sometimes confuse the fact that David was just this bold man, he had so much faith, and it was all about him, then in his strength that he slayed Goliath, and it has nothing to do with that. In fact, when David goes up to sling the stone at Goliath, before he says, if God can protect me from the mouth of the lion and the bear as a shepherd boy in the field, these things that mean nothing, how much more will he protect me against someone mocking the nation of Israel? So he takes Goliath down, takes his sword, cuts off his head, and parades it in front of Israel as a major victory. And they wipe out this clan of Philistines, they chase him down, and there's a great victory in Israel. And because of that, in chapter 18, we see that Israel loves David. When he comes back, there was a phrase that is actually mentioned in our reading today that we'll revisit. When he comes back into town after his military conquests, the people of Israel and the women of Israel start saying, Saul has slayed his thousands and David his 10,000s. The glory and the honor and the reputation was now flooding over David and leaving Saul. And later in chapter 18, we see that Saul tries to kill David out of envy and anger. He hurls a spear at him multiple times. God protects him, or Saul is terrible at throwing a spear. Either one can be true, okay? Later in chapter 18, we learn that David becomes Saul's son-in-law, despite Saul attempting to get David killed in battle. So here's Saul's plan. He's still so upset at David and the fact that he has the Spirit of God on him. He's successful where he goes. And if he kills him in the public square, kills him publicly, that's going to be a problem for him, isn't it? So Saul devises a plan. I'm going to tempt David. David, you can become my son-in-law and marry my daughter if you go into battle and kill 100 Philistines and bring me their foreskins. Yes, that is grotesque, but that was what was commanded of him. What does David do? He brings back 200. Saul thought, maybe if I can give David an impossible task, he'll get killed in battle and all my problems will be buried. By the way, David actually uses that strategy later when he has problems too. But instead, David comes out victorious and he returns. And now Saul has a bigger problem because now David is his son-in-law. Saul again tries to kill David, but David is protected. Pastor Jerry taught about this a couple weeks ago in chapter 19 by both Jonathan, who warned of his father going to kill him, or his father's aggression. We see that his wife protected him. When they were going to his home, she allowed him to escape, and she put idols in the bed to make it look like a person, which is kind of a problem that they had idols in the home, isn't it? They took the bed up to the palace. They realize it's not David. By this time, he has already escaped. And then Saul sends 3 platoons of soldiers to go and capture David. David goes to Naoth, or Naoth. It's a very interesting name. It's difficult to pronounce. He goes to another city of priests, and each platoon of people that go to try to capture David end up worshiping God, essentially, reading his word, prophesying. And Saul himself, he tries to do the job himself. After 3 squads of men have not returned, and he too ends up being convicted by the Spirit and not killing David. Pastor Adam taught last week in chapter 20, Saul's angry again. And there's the new moon feast. David doesn't show up for a couple days in a row. And when he learns that Jonathan is more than likely helping David, and that Jonathan gave Saul a lie to cover up what David was doing, Saul tries to kill his own son. He's that upset at David. And he's on the hunt. And in chapter 20, we see that Jonathan proves his covenant to David and protects him and gives him a warning to flee as Saul is again hunting him down to take his life. What happens is if before he went to the new moon feast, before Jonathan went, him and David came up with a plan. David was going to hide in a field. And if Saul's response to hearing the news of David's absence was negative and that he wanted to kill David, he would go out. Jonathan would go out with a servant and he would do some target practice with some arrows. Now, David's going to be watching, and he's going to be looking for some key phrases. So he goes out, and if Saul is not upset with David, and he can stay, and he's safe, he's going to shoot the arrow to the side, and he's going to allow the servant to retrieve the arrows. However, if Saul was upset, and that is obviously what ended up happening, he would shoot the arrow past where the boy could reach, and he would shout, "It is beyond you! Go!" And that's what ended up happening. And David, from that point on, was fleeing for his life. Because he knew Saul would stop at nothing because he was even willing to kill his own son. By the way, he threatened his son and said, "Until David is dead, you will not resume kingship after me. If he is alive, you will never be king of Israel." And that's where Saul is at right now. And that brings us to our narrative in chapter 21. Well, actually, I have a little bit more review for you. I've done this 3 times and I still haven't gotten it down. I want to examine a couple points about David before we move forward. The narrative up to this point, it's very clear by all the things we just read from chapter 16 to 20 that the Spirit of the Lord is with David. I'll go back just for a second. All of these things happened because God ordained David's protection. He is the one keeping him safe right now. Another thing that we need to know is that David's military reputation is widely acknowledged. In chapter 18, verse 5, we see that David was successful wherever Saul sent him, and that led to verse 30 later where it says that David had more success than all the servants of Saul, and his name was highly esteemed through all the land. So much so that when David struck the Philistines in chapter 19, he struck them to the point that they fled from him. When the Philistines saw that David was leading an army, they knew they didn't have a chance. It wasn't just Israel, it was the Philistines that knew how the Lord was with David and his success and his power. And up to this point, there's no mention of David being responsible for any negative action or sin, and he's blameless and innocent. Now, here's what I don't want you to interpret that as. David is sinless at this point. He has no sin in his life. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, from chapter 16 to chapter 20, we don't see David being responsible for anything negative that is frowned upon by God or by himself or with Jonathan. He's essentially blameless in this point of the story. Unfortunately, with our narrative, that changes today. Now we can go to chapter 21. And I want to pause at verse 1 just a second to give us some context as to where David is. Then David came to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest. When we last saw David with Jonathan, he was at Gibeah. Now he is in the city of Nob, which actually was a city of priests. Okay, just like Noath or Naoth was that we saw earlier in chapter 19. So David flees, and it's 6 miles away, and he comes to Ahimelech the priest. Now watch this. And Ahimelech came to meet David, trembling, and said to him, "Why are you alone and no one with you?" Now, it kind of caught my attention. Why would a priest be trembling when David approached? Like we mentioned earlier, his reputation is widely acknowledged through Israel, through the enemies, through the Philistines. And I want you to picture for a moment David and the few men that he has with him fleeing. They've traveled 6 miles. I don't know if they were running, walking. I don't know how the journey went. But David approaches with a small ragtag group of people. He's probably looking exhausted, sweaty, tired, hungry. And the priest probably is thinking, uh-oh. If the anointed future king is coming to me for help, something's really wrong. So he approaches David trembling, and he says, "Why are you alone and no one with you?" He did have a few companions. We'll see that later. But generally, it's just you and a few people. "Why are you alone?" And David said to Ahimelech the priest, "The king has charged me with a matter and said to me, 'Let no one know anything of the matter about which I send you and with which I have charged you. I have made an appointment with these young men for such and such a place. Now then, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever is here.'" What's the problem? David lies. He approaches Ahimelech, a priest. By the way, Nob was in the territory of Benjamin. Is that pretty significant with David's background? So he shows up to Ahimelech, who he would have known, and he lies. He says, "Ahimelech, listen, I've been sent on a secret mission by the king. I was told to tell nobody about it. I can't tell you any information about it, but me and my men are starving. Can you give us some food? Even some bread, that would be fine." David lies. Now, I want to acknowledge for a second, I can ask the question, did David have to lie? Obviously, the answer is no. But I do want to put us in his seat for just a second. The king of Israel, who has authority to get information and get people however he needs them. If he was looking for David, he could, kind of like a wanted poster, right? Anybody that sees him needs to bring him to me. If he learns that someone harbored David and helped him, he could very easily kill that person. So David knows that by sharing information with Ahimelech that it could put his own life in danger. And David, to try to cover himself up, his trail behind him to cover that up, and potentially to protect Ahimelech, he chooses to lie. Our first question as we go through this morning, has fear ever caused you to sin? And I don't want anybody to respond to me because I think the answer would be overwhelmingly yes by probably every person in this room. It's interesting with the bumper video that Peter chose for this morning, I told them that we're going to be talking about fear. And I really like what they mention in there is that the phrase "do not fear" or "have no fear" or "don't be afraid" is mentioned 365 times in Scripture. Some may say that that's a coincidence because we have 365 days in the year. Or we could look at it and say, man, it's so important that there's one for every day of the year that we need to be reminded not to have fear. And David here has fear for himself, fear for Ahimelech, and he chooses to lie. Has fear ever caused you to sin just like David just did? And it's not over, by the way. If we continue, he's asked for the bread, and the priest answered David, "I have no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread, if the young men have kept themselves from women." And David answered the priest, "Truly, women have been kept from us as always when I go on an expedition. The vessels of the young men are holy, even when it is an ordinary journey. How much more today will their vessels be holy?" So the priest gave him the holy bread, for there was no bread there but the bread of the presence, which is removed from before the Lord to be replaced by hot bread on the day it is taken away. I want to pause for just a second, because in a 21st century American context, we do not know what's happening right now. At first, when he says, "I don't have any common bread on him, but there is holy bread," immediately my mind jumps to the two buns on a Chick-fil-A sandwich that we know is pre-blessed by the Lord before we order it and eat it. That's not the case. Actually, it tells us here that the holy bread that's being referenced is specifically the bread of the presence. And we should ask, too, as we go through, why is it important that when he gives him, "I do have some bread, the holy bread, but have you guys kept yourselves from women?" I've never really had that standard when ordering a sandwich before, okay? So there's something very specific happening here right now. So I want to talk about what the bread of the presence is so we can understand what's happening. The bread of the presence is 12 loaves of bread arranged in two stacks of six on the table of the showbread. The table of showbread was located in the holy place of the tabernacle and temple near Yahweh's presence. And I should have put a picture on here. I've apologized to the other services too. I didn't think to do it, but I'll explain it briefly. In the tabernacle or the temple, symbolically, the Holy of Holies, which is where the Ark of the Covenant was the physical, literal presence of Yahweh, which is kind of hard to comprehend today. But you go from the outer court to the inner court, and in the inner court, you would have the altar where the priest would offer the sacrifice for someone's sins, and then they would go to the bronze laver, which was the next step closer towards the tabernacle or the temple. They'd wash their hands, they'd be ceremonially clean from the sacrifice they just offered, and then they would go into the holy area of the tabernacle, and as you walked in, the table of showbread would always be facing the north side of the tent, and it would have these 12 loaves of bread on it, stacked in two stacks of six. You'd have the lampstand, and then right before the veil, you'd have the altar of incense. And the veil was a massive, ornate, elaborate curtain, for lack of better terms. It was one piece, and it separated the holy area from the Holy of Holies, which was literally God's presence resting there. And only priests had the authority to go in and partake in the temple or the tabernacle. Now, this bread that was on the table was replaced weekly on the Sabbath with hot bread, and the priests were allowed to eat the old bread, and they were the only ones that were allowed to eat the bread that was replaced. There's a lot of symbolism as to what the bread means and why it's here, and for the sake of time, we're not going to do a deep dive into it, but here's what I want you to walk away with. This bread symbolized one aspect of the covenantal relationship shared between Israel and Yahweh. God was not dependent on man, but man dependent on God for food and provision. And an example of that would be the manna in the wilderness that God provided to Israel. And actually, in the Ark of the Covenant is some of that preserved manna that was still there in the Ark of the Covenant. So this bread is highly symbolic, and it's also reserved only for the priests to eat, only after it was taken out. Does that help us get a little bit more context as to what we're looking at? Okay. Now, I have a question, because David's asking for this bread. Ahimelech's like, "Well, I have this bread if you've kept yourself from women," right? Which, talking about the priests, explains that standard. But then I have a question. Is it even lawful for David and his men to eat this bread, since it is only reserved for the priests? Thankfully, Jesus spoke about this directly in Mark chapter 2, so I don't even have to wonder, because he explains it. Okay, so if you want to keep your finger here, you can flip to Mark chapter 2. If not, I have it on the screen. We're only going to be there for a minute. But in Mark chapter 2, we see that on the Sabbath, we need to remember the day. It's the Sabbath. It's the day of rest. Jesus was going through the grain fields, and his disciples walked along, and they began to pick some heads of grain. The Pharisees said to him, "Look, why are they doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath? Why are you working and picking grain on the Sabbath?" If you don't know this, the Pharisees were looking for any opportunity to catch Jesus on a legal charge. And this is one they thought they had him on. And Jesus answered, Have you never read what David did when he and his companions were hungry and in need? He actually references back to this reading that we're in today. In the days of Abiathar, the high priest, okay, let's pause for a second. If you're paying attention, you might be like, hey, that's not the weird name that we saw a few minutes ago. Ahimelech is the priest that we've mentioned earlier that is having the conversation with David, yet Jesus, when he references the story, says Abiathar was the high priest. If you come back next week, you will see Abiathar. He is the son of Ahimelech, and you will see why Jesus references him as the high priest of this time, because something tragic happens as a result of David's actions next week. In the days of Abiathar, the high priest, he entered the house of God and ate the consecrated bread, which is lawful only for priests to eat. Even Jesus says it. He and his companions were in need, and they entered, and they ate the bread, which was only for the priests. And he also gave some to his companions. Then he said this to them, "The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath." And this is what really drove him up a wall. "So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath." What's happening here, if you see Jesus say he is the Son of Man, that would have lit the Pharisees' fuse immediately. Why? Because the Son of Man was a title reserved only for the Messiah, and the Pharisees did not believe Jesus was him. And so when he goes through, I just want to picture this for a second. He's eating, he's allowing his disciples to pick grain. The Pharisees are like, "You're working on the Sabbath. What are you doing?" Jesus immediately responds and says, "Yeah, but have you even read about what happened with David and his men?" But I still have a question, because even Jesus admits it was only lawful for the priest to eat. So how do we harmonize these two ideas? In my study this week, John MacArthur has a really good explanation of this. One of the many places I looked this week, but I think the wording of his is really, really good. He says, Jesus' point, as illustrated by the Old Testament account, was that showing compassion in God's sight always trumped strict adherence to ritual and ceremony. His illustration employed the familiar rabbinic style of arguing from the lesser to the greater. What John MacArthur is saying here is the rabbis, traditionally, when they were trying to argue or make a point, they would talk about the least important first and the most important last. And so Jesus even does this here. If it was permissible for Ahimelech, a human priest, to make an exception to God's ceremonial law in order to aid David and his men, it was surely appropriate for the Son of God to disregard unbiblical rabbinic tradition in order to meet the needs of his disciples. So what's happening here? Compassion trumps adherence to ritual and ceremony. Was it ceremonially only for the priest to eat? Yes. Yes, it was. And what Jesus is saying here is if a human sinful priest can make an exception, and by the way, you will not find condemnation for this action in Scripture anywhere. God is not frustrated. He doesn't condemn anybody. He doesn't say anything negative about this. If Ahimelech is able to make an exception for David and his men to give this ceremonially symbolic bread, that's all it was. It was ceremonial and it was symbolic to them for food to eat in their journey. How much more can God himself in human form in this situation disregard unbiblical rabbinic tradition in order to meet the needs of his disciples? What they were doing was not illegal. There are two things that we need to look at with Jewish law. There was the written law, which was given by God, written by man. And then there was the oral law. Now, the oral law was a set of a bunch of rules that the Pharisees, the religious leaders, added on top of the written law to further govern the people. Not from God, not biblical. And for them to pick grain on the Sabbath was not necessarily even considered work, but yet they were trying to get him on a semantic detail of their oral law. And so Jesus references back and says, honestly, if the priest that I have instructed in Exodus to be in the tabernacle, if I allowed that to be eaten by David and his men, who, by the way, we are learning he's not telling the truth, it's okay. They can eat the grain. It's fine. So my second application question this morning, and this may not make sense for a second, but what sacred traditions do you need to set aside for the purpose of helping someone in need? Pastor Colby, we're talking about Jesus and the disciples, and we're talking about oral Torah, oral law. We're talking about David here. That doesn't apply to me. Well, no. However, I think I have allowed myself to let my traditions and the things that I hold sacred keep me from serving other people. And potentially, I mean, Ahimelech could have said, legally, could have said, no, David, I'm sorry, I can't help you. This is only for the priests. He could have said that. But instead, he gave the bread to David, and there's no written condemnation of that action at all. So I would ask you, what things are you putting in your way as maybe intentional barriers to helping other people? What things do you need to lay aside that really aren't as important as you think they are in order to help somebody else? Now, this next verse feels like it's shoehorned in the passage. Now, verse 7 says this, "Now, a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day." Catch this. "He was detained before the Lord. His name was Doeg the Edomite, the chief of Saul's herdsmen." In the next verse, we continue in their conversation. If you come back, and I would encourage you to come back or encourage you to keep reading on your own, chapter 22, the next chapter, there's really, really fatal consequences to David's choice. And Doeg has a massive role in that. So as the writer is encouraging us to pay attention to the conversation that's happening between David and Ahimelech, he's also giving us a little footnote. Hey, this person was here, but he's important for what we're about to read. He plays a major role in the next chapter. So that's why he's mentioned here. Okay, Doeg the Edomite. Now we continue in the conversation. "Then David said to Ahimelech, 'Then have you not here a spear or a sword at hand? For I have brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's business required haste.'" David is embellishing the lie. He's continuing. Not only did he lie about being on an urgent mission, now he's lying about why he doesn't have a weapon. "Because the king's business required such haste, I didn't have time to grab something." Two things can be true at once. It can be true that David did not have time to grab a weapon because he was fleeing from Saul, and it can also be true that he's lying about being on a mission. But he continues to embellish the lie, hoping to get some sympathy and some help from Ahimelech. "And the priest said this, 'The sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you struck down in the valley of Elah, behold, it is here, wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you will take that, take it, for there is none but that here.' And David said, 'There is none like it. Give it to me.'" I want you to just picture for a moment, Goliath was 9'9". I can't even reach that high. If you read about Goliath earlier, his armor weighed over 100 pounds. I believe the tip of his spear was about 25 pounds. That dude was a monster. He could lift some weight. So I would imagine the sword that he carried was one of a kind. And David recognizes the sword because actually he takes it out of Goliath's hand and cuts his own head off with it. And then parades Saul's head through Israel, which sounds brutal, but he was parading the victory that God had just given them. And Ahimelech is like, "Hey, the only thing I have is that gargantuan battle sword. If you want it, you can have it." So he grabs it and he takes it. Now, what we're about to read, there's something incredibly poetic about what we're going to see, and I want to see if you pick up on it, okay? So tune your minds, look for something that's going to be a little interesting, something you might have seen before. I want to see if you catch it. "And David arose that day, taking the sword of Goliath, and fled and went to Achish, the king of Gath. And the servants of Achish said to him, 'Is this not David, the king of the land?'" Yeah, this is that guy, isn't it? The one that they sang their songs, "Saul is thousands, David is tens of thousands." The people of Gath start to recognize him. And this further proves our point that David's military prowess was widely acknowledged. But then we continue. "And David took these words to heart," the fact that he was being recognized, "and was much afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. So he changed his behavior before them and pretended to be insane in their hands. And he made marks on the doors of the gate and let his spittle run down his beard." Then Achish said to his servants, "Behold, you see this man is mad. Why then have you brought him here to me? Do I lack madmen that you've brought this guy to me and put him in my presence?" He's like, "I've got enough of these people right now. And you're bringing him to me? Shall this fellow come into my house?" Essentially what he's saying is, get him out of my presence. Send him away. I've got enough crazy people. I don't need another one. Did you catch what was poetic? What do we know about Gath? That's Goliath's hometown. That's where Goliath came from. So David, the first time he held this sword, was a complete and utter trust in God, faith in God's provision, and victory that God had handed him. The second time he holds this sword, and by the way, returns to the town where it was more than likely forged, he is a fearful deceiver. Same guy, same sword, different mentality. And it's interesting because he knew that people were starting to recognize him, and I would think probably recognize that one-of-a-kind sword that was fashioned for a 10-foot-tall man. And when it says here that he made marks on the gate, he didn't take a sword and start cutting up the door. What it means is that he acted like a feral cat and started clawing the posts of the doorframe, and letting spit run down his beard is something I'll never be able to experience. I haven't been blessed with a beard, so I don't know what that's like. But he let spit run down his beard. And the immediate image I get is something like rabies, somebody with a severe issue. So David's plan to not get recognized or to not have penalty for being who he is comes up with a plan and says, you know what? I'm just going to act like I'm mentally snapped. The David that they know is not the David they're going to get. And so I'm going to act like something happened, something's wrong with me, and I'm insane. I'm going to act like a feral animal, claw at the posts. I'm going to act rabid, let spit run down my beard, act like I have severe issues. So when they look at me and remember what God has done through me, they'll forget it. Because what they see is not the David that they knew. Question number three, has fear ever caused you to change who you are? Let's not forget who David is. The anointed one, the anointed future king of Israel, the one that nobody can touch. Nobody. He's been protected by God at every step of the way. The one that has unbridled, unmitigated military conquest. Nobody is like him. And yet, because of fear, in the same place, with the same weapon, not the same place, but the same weapon, in the hometown of the person that he had victory over, the one that God gave him victory over, he completely abandons who God has made him to be in order not to be killed. Now, we like to think in hypotheticals, I do anyway. What would have happened if he didn't do this? What would have happened if he were to go to Gath and they recognized him and they started to fight him? Could he have killed a ton of people with that sword? That would have been cool to read about. Would God have supernaturally intervened like he has in the chapters that we've read and allow him to escape? We'll never know. Because what David decided to do was take his fear and let that totally overwhelm his faith in the God that he had just seen move in his life time after time after time after time again. I want us to look at the points that we mentioned at the beginning. I've titled David the Anointed Underdog, and I think that's a title probably multiple people have used. We haven't communicated about it, but I think that's a fairly common title about David. He's anointed by God. He is the underdog. He is the shepherd boy. He's the youngest brother. He's the one no one looks at. But yet he is the one that God decides to place his spirit on and anoint and bless and protect. with all these points that we just read. And this week, because he was overwhelmed with fear, he is now the fearful deceiver. He lies about being on a secret mission to acquire food. He lies about his mission being urgent to acquire a weapon, and he feigned insanity in order to flee. If you are just joining us today and this is your first lesson that you've heard of David in 1 Samuel, you're like, what happened to this guy? How did this become this? And I think all of us should be asking that question. The answer is fear. And I've heard fear put this way: the best way to describe fear is a lack of trust in God. Simple. Why fear the dark? It doesn't apply that way. Well, you know what I mean. When we fear man, when we fear the world systems, when we fear what's going on politically, everything around us, our world is a mess right now. Even if horrible things were to happen, does that change who God is? But yet in our mind, when we start to be inconvenienced and when we're afraid, we suddenly think the God that's been protecting us and blessing us just left. He's focusing on somebody else and totally forgot about me. And it causes us, and it caused David, to suddenly say, yeah, this guy, this God that's been protecting me and been providing for me, I think I can do better. Because this journey with Saul is not ending, it's getting worse. And so my last question this morning is, has fear ever caused you to lose faith in the sovereign God that watches over you? Hear me, that is so much easier said than done. It's really easy to say that when things are going good in life and things are going bad in someone else's, and you get a perspective slap. But then when trials enter your life and life gets difficult or slightly inconvenient or very inconvenient, I think we've all had moments like that. Well, wherever God is, he's not doing anything right now. He's allowing this to happen. And by the way, you're right about that. If you go to James chapter 1, you will see that James tells us to rejoice when we have trials. He says, consider it pure joy. And I don't even know, what is pure joy? You can think of when your kids were born, or precious time with your family. I don't like pure joy, that's such a high expectation. But he says, consider it pure joy when you encounter trials, not if. And what's the purpose? It causes you to grow in perseverance. And the reason he's allowing trials, and I'm paraphrasing at this point, so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking a single thing. And I know in my life when things happen, and I know that some of our grades of difficulty and trial may vary, but when I have trials in my life, I think the immediate human flesh response in my own life is to say, why are you doing this, God? In a negative way, in almost a condemning way. But there actually is a way that you can ask the same question with a different tone. God, why? Why are you doing this? What do I have to learn? Because Scripture says, James, one of the half-brothers of Jesus, wrote that, and he says, by the way, when you have trials in your life, it's intentional. If something happened in your life, if a trial is happening in your life that God was not aware of, he ceases to be God. Have you ever thought about that? If anything in the universe happens without his purview, it would completely disqualify him from being God of the universe. And I think David fell into that trap. God must not be seeing me right now. He was protecting me, and he has been, but he's left. He's forgot. He's got other business to attend to. And oftentimes, God will give us the trial that he knows we need. I don't know if you've had that experience in life, where you think you've got things under control and God throws you that curveball that knocks your socks off. You're unprepared for it, but yet when you look back on it now, man, I really needed that. Not all the time, but most times. And man, I don't know, like David has an extreme. He's clawing the door like a feral cat. He's letting spit run down his beard. He's pretending to be mentally broken. I've never done that. You don't have to. Let me remind you of another character in Scripture named Peter, who was one of the best friends of Jesus, one of the three that saw him transfigured, one that actually later in life was crucified on a cross, upside down because he didn't feel like he was worthy to die the same way Jesus did. He had a moment in his life when Jesus was arrested where people started to recognize him as a follower of Jesus. And what did he say? I don't know him. I've never seen him. I've never met him. I'm paraphrasing. He totally, three times, not just once, three times, he totally gave up and abandoned his entire relationship that he's had with Jesus. I don't know who you're talking about. I am not him. I have no affiliation or association. Peter fell into the same trap. What happens if I am going to get crucified for being a follower of Jesus? Well, guess what? He ended up getting crucified anyway. But I'm going to lie to protect my own identity and my comfort in the process of abandoning what God has proven to be true up to that point. And David did the same thing. I have done the same thing. I am not innocent of this. And what's interesting about Peter, I know our study's not on Peter, but just thinking through it, when Jesus reappears to him on the shores of Capernaum, what does he ask Peter three times? Do you love me? Well, yes, Lord, of course I do. Do you love me? Yes, I do. Do you love me? He denied Jesus three times. Peter made him reinstate his faith in him three times. And what that shows me, just that example, and even what we see later with David, how God continues to use him, he can still use you. There's not a point where you're too far gone. If Peter can abandon and lie about his entire relationship with Jesus and still be used, and if David, who God has blessed with all of this protection and security, can throw all that in the trash and pretend to be somebody insane and act like none of the things that God did, he actually just did, but yet God can still use him. That actually gives me hope that maybe he can still use me too. Don't let fear control your life. 365 times in Scripture, have no fear, do not be afraid, do not fear. And it's intentional. And as we close today, if you don't know this God that I'm talking about, if you don't know who Jesus is, I've mentioned his name a couple of times this morning, but if that's just a name or a cuss word and you don't really know who he is, I would encourage you to go and talk to one of the pastors in the back, Pastor Adam and Pastor Phil are back there. I'll be up here. Talk to somebody in your row that you trust. Because left to human nature, we will make this decision every time. If we have faith in God, and if we remember what he's done, it's going to be easier to side with him and not with our own understanding. One other point before we close, because I forgot it from what I mentioned earlier. The sword being in the tabernacle, it was kind of a landmark for Israel. It was a physical reminder of what God's done in the past. And if you look through the Old Testament, they would also have something set up called Stones of Ebenezer, or they would set up monuments of stone. What was the purpose? If you're like me, I can forget what God's done 10 minutes after he did it. And if we can fall into that trap, if I can fall into that trap, the Israelites, what they would do is they would set up a physical reminder so that their children, their children's children, their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren, generations down the line, the hope was that when you see this monument set up, it's a reminder of the stories that we've passed down of what God's done. Because you're going to have times that you forget because God's going to seem to be silent for a while. And you forget that he's there. And that sword for Israel, it was a reminder. This was just years before this happened. It wasn't long. But it probably served as a reminder of when times get tough, Man, look at this massive sword that was made for that. Remember, he was 9'9". Remember how crazy that was to look at him on the battlefield? Remember how this tiny shepherd boy brought a sling and took him down? Don't let fear control your life. Fear is a lack of trust in God. And if you don't know that God, if you have no relationship with him, if you want to know more, please, I beg you to talk to somebody before you leave. We're not guaranteed tomorrow. We're not guaranteed tonight. So I would encourage you to find somebody to make that decision. Why don't you stand and we'll close in a word of prayer this morning. Father, thank you for just a few minutes to spend time continuing in your word in 1 Samuel chapter 21 today. I'm just reminded through this story that as a human being, I'm so weak in my faith. I'm so weak in how I can trust you when things happen in my life that I feel like you don't know or that you didn't ordain. And I'm thankful for multiple passages that we've referenced this morning with James 1 just to remind me that when trials happen in life, it's intentional and it's actually you being kind to allow us to grow and mature. I'm thankful for this narrative and the history that we read here with David that he pretended to be insane, completely abandoned his identity that you had graciously blessed him with. But yet, his story's not over, and there's many, many more things that you use him to do. And Peter, after denying you, you still used him. And I pray that if anybody's struggling this morning with doubt or with this mindset that they've failed you so many times they can't be used anymore, I just pray that you help them get that out of their mind because that's not biblical. And as we've approached this topic of fear, God, fear can happen every day. I guarantee most of us will have a situation today where we'll approach a situation where we can have fear, whether that's fear of someone finding out the truth, whether that's fear of not being held up in a conversation, whether that's our reputation on the line, whether that's a financial struggle. Everything that happens in the universe is ordained by you, and that's something hard that we can't really wrap our minds around. But God, you can use every situation to bring glory for yourself. It is not about you. It's not about David. It's not about Ahimelech. It's about you. Dismiss us with your grace today. Thank you for your son, for being willing to die on a cross, the most brutal death in human history that's still considered the most brutal death in human history. So that the sin that I am completely accountable and guilty for and deserve, and the punishment that I deserve, I don't have to take. Give courage to somebody to speak to a friend or a pastor this morning that's convicted by these things, I pray. In your name, amen.